Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
This week, we are sitting down with Chris Sellers, a.k.a. Hectic Electron, designer of games like Raccoon Sky Pirates and the brand new queer sword and sorcery RPG, Defy the Gods. Chris, welcome to the show.
Welcome.
Hi, thanks. Hi, great to be here.
Great to have
you. So good to have you.
Very good to have a fellow a Columbus native on the show.
Chris, I have to give you awards for most prepared interview booker ever, because you booked this interview 6 months in advance, which I think is a record for preparedness on this show. So
it's a record
by
an extent of like 4 months.
I really wanted to get on.
Yeah, no, and we're so glad to have you. So today, Chris, we want to talk about these two games we mentioned in the intro, Raccoon Sky Pirates and Defy the Gods. And specifically, we want to frame this around sort of a nexus point in your career of the Horizons Fellowship, and talk about what your design career before that looked like, what that offered to you as a designer, and then now what you've been able to accomplish on the other side of it. So I think for folks who don't know, could you just tell us what the Horizons Fellowship is?
Yeah. So GAMA is the Game Manufacturers Association. They do tabletop games, board games, card games, role-playing games, and they run Origins Game Fair, and they have a big business expo in March, and they started basically a DEI initiative for people who have been historically underrepresented in games, in tabletop games, to give them a leg up and a spotlight. And so they give you like an honorarium. They pay for you to go to GAMA Expo that year and to Origins with like a spotlight booth for all the fellows at GAMA Expo, and then like your own booth at Origins. And they pay for travel expenses and hotel and getting booth materials like banner stands and stuff. I mean, they don't pay for, you know, they give you a stipend for it, and it's really generous. And my hat's off to GAMA for doing it. I think it's been really great. It certainly gave me a spotlight last year. It was fantastic. They also give you a mentor, which is like worth its weight in gold right there. Like that plus the networking were the things I got most out of. So it's like, it's really generous. It's amazing. And they are really committed to it in a way that I really appreciate at a time when some people don't think DEI is very fashionable. Yeah. So it was a big help.
It is a thing that, like, don't get me wrong, money is a huge help. Money is always helpful. But having like mentors and just like an organization there that knows the stuff that you don't, like, the thing that always happens is you don't know what you don't know until you need to know it. And usually by the time you figure it out, you owe a fee somehow.
Yeah, right. It's too late.
There is a tax on ignorance in this country. And it shouldn't be that way. And like when you have a mentor and we have like an organization like GAMA coming in and giving you all of this like help, I would imagine, and I'd love to hear more from you, but I imagine it's just a huge leg up and just a huge like jumping. It's a springboard that gets you to the next level.
It starts with a validation that like you are doing stuff that we think is valuable. And then it becomes like, we're going to showcase you. We're going to give up valuable exhibit hall floor space to showcase you, and we're going to sort of bring you around to these mixers and things. So yeah, really wonderful. And I got to have as my mentor Kat Tobin, who's the publisher of Pelgrane, and I already was convention friends with her, and so it was really lovely to get to spend more time with her. And oh my god, she saved my bacon on Defy the Gods several times.
What do you think from that, like that mentorship, what do you think are there like any specific pieces of like advice or mentorship that you got that you think are worthwhile just like putting out into the ether to anyone listening to this?
Yeah, like pay artists as well as you can afford, and what you pay them now as you're starting out is going to just naturally become your template for what you pay artists in future projects. So pay them as well as you can now, because that will become what you think of as the expected amount later, you know, whether you mean to or not. you can expect to sell, if you run a Kickstarter or a crowdfunding campaign, you can expect to sell that many again number of games afterward. So don't set your print run too high. Like I don't know if you guys know, but I had 2 Defy the Gods Kickstarters. I had one in the spring of last year that I had to cancel because it wasn't going to make. And then I ran another one with much more modest goals that actually did really well. And I just like, you know, God willing, I will print as many as I thought I was going to print in my first Kickstarter, but I didn't need to print that many in order to make the book real, you know? Yeah. And understand the appeal of your game, how niche it is.
Yeah. I want to underline that. I don't know if that's a thing we've talked about on the show before, but like you Kickstarted this twice. And the second time it worked. Like it not working the first time didn't mean it was over for the game. The game now exists.
Oh yeah. And definitely if it's not going to make, don't make it just a struggle to this horrible, unwanted conclusion. Cut it off before the time runs out. That's a lot better than saying, oh God, we didn't fund. And the second one was almost 200%. Funded, so you know it was good.
I know Watt recently from Designer of Cloud Empress had a Kickstarter that was going really well and then but wasn't going to make the amount that they really needed to make that thing happen and decided on canceling it, like finding a new way to fund it or like look at doing another thing. I imagine that is a, and correct me if I'm wrong, a really hard thing to have to, like the day after you cancel it, that's got to suck. And then, commendations to you for like getting back on the horse and like making it happen.
Thank you. Thank you. It's humbling, you know? Yeah. Like, but I've been very fortunate to be surrounded by a lot of good people in this industry. And everyone just wants to see great games, you know? But yeah, so very much humble pie the day before, the day of, the day after. And then I started working on how to make it work again. Actually, it's actually a really useful set of data because you're like, well, I know this many people are going to back it. So as I can get everybody back, and I really had to sort of be banging the drum a lot to say, no, come back. But like, then you're like, oh, okay, well, that's my funding goal. Whatever it was at 3 weeks into the first one.
And did this coincide with while you were a fellow? Was it when you went through this?
Yeah. So it was really great to be running it while I'm a fellow, while I'm getting active weekly advice from Kat, while I have all these other fellows and other people associated with the program to bounce things off of, you know, because like I still have access to that Discord. That might go away next year. I forget. But like as a 1-year alum, I still have access. But like I'm not the belle of the ball anymore. And last year I was one of them, you know, and they were really quick to give me a lot of advice. And so that was lovely.
That's awesome. So I guess windowing in a little bit more, we started talking about it, Defy the Gods. First, can you tell us what is Defy the Gods? And then we'll kind of talk a little bit about its journey.
Yeah. A queer sword and sorcery adventure romance set in fantasy ancient Mesopotamia. So Bronze Age vibes inspired by Clash of the Titans, Conan, of course, Princess Mononoke, where you and your friends live in a world where jealous gods and cruel tyrants want to destroy you. And you build that world yourself. You make your own pantheon, you make your own city-state, you make your own other forces of the world, and then they're all out to get you. So it's got a lot of sword and sorcery archetypes, but everyone is also a recognizable figure from queer life.
Tell me more about that. How do you merge sword and sorcery archetypes with like someone you would recognize from queer life?
Well, so I mean, I started with a lot of love for sword and sorcery stories and mythic stories, which is actually sort of, you know, sword and sorcery stories are often kind of low magic where you're in this sort of very noir city, but the mythic stories like Clash of the Titans, obviously you're a big hero, but nobody's a big hero in this. The gods hate you. But anyway, so sorry, I steeped myself in the source material, Conan, Fafnir and the Grey Mouser, Elric, big Elric vibes. And then I tried to bring it home and make it real. And you know, you might be a sword lesbian. You might be a polyamorous disaster. You might be in a submissive relationship with an exiled god who loves you, but you have to hurt yourself, you wound yourself to perform their miracles. I want to say some of these are my favorite, but like you might be a human raised in the wilds and curious about the human world and not really belonging in either one. And you might be a fugitive who's escaped from the underworld and you're not who you were in your past life and not who you were when you were dead and you're figuring out who you are now. And so that's the revenant. You know, you are actually coming back from the underworld. The vessel has this relationship with the god, again, very BDSM vibes, with a real caring relationship at his core. And you're the sailor who's wide traveled and has a network of exes, like is my polyamorous disaster. So like, so the real Conan one is my sword lesbian, although you could play it as a himbo too, who's just doesn't bow to anybody, protects her friends above everything else, and has a big fucking sword. I'm leaving some out, but yeah. And then for the stretch goals, I got to write the thief, who was like the worst part of me, like the total liar and backstabber. So like I had a lot of fun with that.
I've never thought of the, it's such a great little change, but I've never thought of the I know a guy could be the I dated a guy.
Totally. It's 100%. Yeah.
You add one extra word there, but it adds a lot of context.
Yeah.
It adds fun scenes to like anytime you have to use the I know a guy kind of thing in a game where it's like, well, I know a guy, but I don't really want to talk to him.
Right. Some I know a guy. Good,
I'm not sure
bad.
How well it ended. I'm going to roll to see how well it ended. You know?
Really good.
Anytime
and how
you're
well
in a city,
I thought it ended.
Yeah. Right. Totally. How well, you know, you're in a city where you've been before. You can just say that somebody in the scene is someone you know or have dated. Yeah. So. It was good.
That's awesome. I want to jump back to kind of where this game started. I know in the press kit you mentioned a 4-year development process. What was the like that first nugget of what would become Defy the Gods?
Like it came out kind of just seeped up out of my subconscious. Like I was I wanted a fantasy adventure. In a way, this was my fantasy heartbreaker. You know, like I want to do my spin on D&D, but that was just sort of one of the things that started it. I wanted to get that sense of like, you know, and maybe make the whole world from Olympus to Tartarus so that like, you know what the stakes are, you know what the, you know the bounds of this world, even though most of it's unexplored. And then my brother died, and I wanted a game that felt like really full of life and really juicy. And one where death was a thing, even though as it turned out, death in the game ends up not being final necessarily, but the underworld is a place, it's hungry, it's patient. I wanted that shadow to be in there. But like, I really wanted to feel exuberant, like this wild ride, you know, so it works really well as a story game because you know, it's going to end at some point, but it feels really wild while you're getting there. And so also I just wanted to make a big swing, you know, I guess because my brother, like I wanted it to, be a like big ambitious project and it ended up being over 300 pages full of amazing art. So like, I think I landed that one. And it kind of gravitated towards Sword and Sorcery because Sword and Sorcery always like feels, especially those Conan stories, really feels juicy and physical, like really physically present. And then working in the romance really just sort of reflected how I was feeling at the time, really kind of in love with everyone and everything. So the Sumerian Mesopotamian thing came about when trying to find like a physical, like material touchstone for the kinds of stories that I imagine Conan in. Like I've seen these paintings of Conan covers where he's in some unspecified ancient temple, and Mesopotamia, sort of the dawn of writing, turned out to be a really good fit for that. And it made it less orientalist, where you're just making, you know, as opposed to making some really vague, oh, the East kind of shit. Like you can actually have it grounded in a certain time and place, even if you end up making your own version of that. So it was all these inchoate things, and it started out as like a bag builder. It started out with like the dice pools. It was a lot of different things. And then I was lucky enough to have Ray Najati do a lot of editing of my ideas. And I started to get really attracted to a lot of the mechanics in his Apocalypse Keys, where you can roll too high and things go off the rails. And that started to feel really sword and sorcery. And then I wove in some Thirsty Sword Lesbians because I really liked the double-edged nature of those relationships and that sort of flirting mechanic. And then with a lot of help from Avery Alder and Ray and Lila McBee Fujiwara, like it started to take shape. Boy, with a lot of help.
It is always great to just like highlight how much help helps. Like it really does. And like how much it unlocks what the game actually wants to be by like the people that you talk to and the experience that they have can define so much of what you end up doing.
Yeah. I wanted it to be GM-less, and Avery was, because I really like the ethic of that, you know, and Avery was like, if you're telling a story with an arc, it kind of needs a GM. Are you telling a story with an arc? And I was like, yes, I am, you know, and yeah. And Lila, my God, I would not have finished this, I don't think, without her help. Like it's like, you don't have to make every game, you know, you just have to make one.
Wow, that's a great piece of advice. You don't have to make every game, you just have to make one.
We just played this, I don't know why, I don't know if this fully connects, but it just reminded me of it. We just played a game last night, we played a role-playing game last night, and someone commented to my player who was being kind of obnoxious, or my character was being kind of obnoxious, hey, you don't have to be for everybody. And it was like a savage line to another character. But it is a good thing to remember for like... games as well. Like you can make more games, like just make this one as much as it wants to be.
I think after this one it's easier for me, you know, to do that, to let a game have a focus, since I poured so much into this one.
We got the Fantasy Heartbreaker out, you know, so now you're free, the shackles are undone.
And I guess part of what happened in the process of completing it was like moving past the idea of my Fantasy Heartbreaker and making like this game, you know, and trying to dial it in, you know, with a lot of playtesting. Yeah, just this game.
I do love how the playbooks, I am less familiar with Powered by the Apocalypse games than I should be at this point in my gaming career. It is a source of shame for me. But I do really love, just looking through the playbooks, how much the mechanics help to define an arc. Because, like, you know, it doing too well, all of a sudden you're gaining flame.
Yeah, your fire gets higher, your fire gets higher,
getting
and that can lead to doom. Yeah.
Exactly, like defying the gods and doom. And like, I very quickly see, like just from a quick glance over stuff and kind of like looking through the playbooks, I'm like, oh, I know how this character is going to feel in kind of act one, act two, act three. And that gives me so much to play with as a player. Like I kind of know roughly, it's not pre-prescribed, but I know roughly the direction I'm going in. And that's a huge help. And it's so much easier than your character sheet is just a bunch of numbers.
Oh boy, right? Yeah. I love that about Powered by the Apocalypse. I think the real danger with any PBTA game is we have decided on where your character's going to go for you. So I really wanted to preserve that tension of, yes, there's an upward doom spiral towards sort of monstrous godlike power, but you can choose to hang on to your relationships. As vulnerable as they make you, they'll keep you human. Keep that tension in there and let that be up for the player to decide. While still doing the strengths of PBTA or any story game, right, where it's like it lets you tell certain beats or kinds of stories that you just wouldn't have gotten into if you were just a murder hobo.
Yeah, on the, like, it feels like one of the ways that you sort of hold on to that core is this idea of the mechanic of epithets. Can you talk a bit about that mechanic specifically?
Yeah. Yeah. So informed by Aegon, also informed by just like the Iliad that I was listening to on audio at the time, like you set up what your own stats are going to be. And each one is a phrase that describes who you are, what you believe in, how you act. It often says that you always do X. You know, it's like who does blah blah blah. But it's meant to be something that you can fall down on, so that when you take harm in a battle, you wound one of your epithets. When you fail to live up to one of your epithets, somebody can call you out on it, and you can wound one of your epithets. You start out with three. There's a track of five. You can get more over time. And when you defy the gods and you roll too high with that and you get a doom, you overwrite one of your epithets with the doom. So the doom is a new phrase, and when you overwrite all your epithets with dooms, your character's over. They've become a new world force, an antagonist, and you sort of slide that character sheet over to the GM and they can use them to make everybody's lives harder. Yeah, so it can be wounded, at which point, usually it's like plus zero, plus one, plus two, plus three or whatever. And the doom epithets are like worth plus three, plus five, really high, so that you're more likely to roll too high with them. If you wound all your epithets, you trigger a crisis scene. And afterward, you have to rewrite one of those epithets to show you at your lowest moment. And it becomes worth more, but it's something that in playing it out, you're playing out kind of your worst side or your weakest self.
Right. I've become really enamored lately with Realis, Austin Walker's game. And the epithets really are scratching that same itch as like character sentences in Realis. I love that. That way of, it's such a fun way to define a character of just like, I always this, I always that.
It seems like the power of like whispers in the Wild Sea, I feel like is a very similar thing.
Ooh. Okay, wait, remind me about whispers. I've read it, but I haven't played it.
Whispers, or Elliot, you GM'd our Wild Sea season, I'll let you do it.
Whispers are like short phrases that every character has as like a resource in the Wild Sea. Mm. And they're more vibey, I would say, than like the epithets here and the like Realis sentences. But they are like phrases of power that people can use to like alter the game in different ways and like do something kind of extraordinary with their character. So I just love phrases and sentences as power and mechanic is always just so interesting.
And it's weird, right? Because like in Defy the Gods, there are like basic moves that everyone can do, and you can just choose which epithet you're doing with it. I mean, my hat is off to every player who chose their weakest epithet just because it fit best. And also there's a bit of ambivalence about having a high ranked epithet because you might roll too high and maybe you don't want that. That's like success, but more success than you bargained for. So what this game is not worried about is like making sure that there is some kind of, that somebody's going to be stronger in a kind of move than somebody else is. You know, I don't really care about that. The story works fine without saying, oh, you've got a two smarts and I've got a zero smarts, you know, and this move has to pick smarts. So that was really interesting to sort of move away from that kind of orthodoxy of PBTA.
And it feels like the epithets are really giving a certain amount of customization to the playbooks for people, where it's like my polyamorous disaster could look really different from somebody else's based on my epithets, even though we're doing some of the same moves.
A slew of them are suggested, but you can totally make up your own. And there's like a bit in the book about what a good epithet is like.
It's the talk of the
This episode was brought to you by the World Builders Club, a project of Working Families Power, an organization building power for the multiracial working class.
The World Builders Club is your go-to dispatch for breaking down the political, cultural, and emotional architecture behind your favorite universes. From romantasy novels and TTRPGs to blockbuster franchises and indie gems. This isn't just pop culture analysis. It's a love letter to the art of creating worlds and the power those worlds have to shape our own. I'm a huge fan of post-apocalyptic world building, so I recommend starting with their piece, We Can't Stop Watching the World End, which talks about properties like GLaDLands, Fallout, and Silo, and what they have to say about humanity and our ability to imagine a world after the apocalypse. But any piece on World Builders Club is going to be a great read for those of us who love to imagine better worlds. So join the club and build a better world with them by subscribing at bit.ly/WBCManySided or by searching World Builders Club on Substack.
Hi, I'm Maia, and this is Maia's Game Room, a narrative actual play anthology featuring short-form, story-driven TTRPGs. Each season tells a new story using a different rules-light system brought to life with sound design, editing, and emotional-rich roleplay. So, if you love cinematic storytelling and character-driven drama, come check out Season 1, set in the haunting world of the Electric State RPG. Just search Maia's Game Room wherever you get your podcasts.
I found that lately when I've been making characters, when I'm playing in role-playing games, I don't end up doing a lot of like backstory. I like to kind of like find it, like whatever the first thing out of my mouth is, that's kind of what the character ends up being. But the one thing that I do is I will go through a character and I would just write like 3 lines of dialogue that are just kind of like, this is who this person is. This is like, if I have nothing else to say in a scene, I can say this, like, oh my God, I'm so excited. It's like, oh wow, look at that. I know exactly who that guy is. If the thing he says most is, wow, look at that. And
yeah.
For whatever reason, like, yeah, sentences in Realis, the epithets in this game, whispers in the wild sea, to a lesser degree, but still there. Having those, I'm finding those more helpful as a player than I maybe thought I would have a year ago.
Because of how they frame the character and just give you an in for the role playing.
It gives you something like very explicit you can use. I think this is also true. You know what this is kind of feeling like as well is Yazeva's Bed and Breakfast, when you're saying like certain explicit moves that you're doing. Sometimes you just, by just literally reading what is on the character sheet, it lets you in a little bit. And now I'm like, okay, I was a little at sea in this moment. Let me just read this move aloud and then be like, oh, right. That's what I'm the guy who's always excited. I'm the person who is sad in this particular instance. It's like, it has been more helpful than I maybe thought. And I think when I first heard about Realis like a year ago, or when I first heard about games that were using this kind of sentence structure, there was a part of me that was like, this is new. Will this work for me? This is a little different. And it apparently does. It's really cool.
Realis is hardcore. And this game is not like that big a break, you know, from things that people are familiar with. But Realis is amazing. I love that. Like the sentences. And you know, I pick lists like most PBTA games have. So like you choose your gender and they're all like usually oblique phrases. Like that also helps. There's lots of others, but I think the gender really helps people get a sense of their character.
Yeah. Especially I always love gender pick lists, specifically in like very queer forward games, are always some of the like most fun bits of writing to hear, and like tell you so much about the voice of the game and like also the author. Like there's so much of like the author's perspective on gender and stuff that often makes it on those lists. It's always a delight.
yeah thanks. Yeah, I had fun with it. You know, sailor can be gold coin tossed in air. I got, you know, I was really inspired by Sleepaway and Dream Askew.
Yeah,
100%.
They really broke that ground.
For anyone who's just curious about what, like, looking at the sailor, I've got it pulled up here. Potential ways to describe your gender: ebb and flow of tides, fair wind, unplumbed depths, scintillating fish scales, relentless shark, gold coin tossed in air. These are great.
Yeah.
These are great.
I want to, something that's come up in here is the move Defy the Gods I want to drill in on, because
I have a small, enthusiastic child in me that still goes, that's the name of the movie, whenever someone says it in a movie. And so I love that there is a move that is the name of the game. Can you tell me what the what Define the Gods looks like quite literally mechanically?
When you stand up to or humiliate any world force, the gods, the city authorities, death, the beasts of the wilds, or the sort of legacy of lost Atlantis, you trigger this move. Or when your fire track maxes out, you trigger this move. Your immortal pride is burning high, and you roll 2d6 plus fire, which usually you max out your track, so it's 4. So you're likely to get a burning success, the sort of too much success. And if you roll a miss, you can you get smacked down for your hubris, and you suffer, and everyone, all the other player characters who stood with you suffer. And if you roll a perfect success, then that's 8 to 10. You face off the authority and you wound them. You invalidate one of their epithets. If this is one of the gods, then one of their 4 domains is no longer a domain of theirs. That's under their control. And you and all who stood with you benefit, and you improve the number of hearts that you share with those people. But if you roll too high, then, you know, if you roll perfect success, you stand up against them like a human being, like in the climactic scene, Princess Mononoke. But if you roll too high, then you stand against them as a world force in your own right for a moment. And so you rise up to immortal height and you face them down. You still wound them, but everyone who stood with you suffers because they're too close to your sort of incandescent glory. And then you come back down to earth, but not before taking a new doom epithet and taking the doom move that goes with it. And these are one of these overpowered moves, like in Apocalypse Keys, where you, like the ruin moves in Apocalypse Keys, where you don't have to roll to do it. You just have to mark fire. So you're increasing your fire track again, which is what creates that vicious cycle. So you sort of stay a little bit a god or an immortal force after the move because you have this new thing. That's it. Awesome. That's the whole thing.
I love it.
And it changes everything, and everything stops, you know. And the hearts that other people who stand with you give to you can pull you back from the brink, you know, like can reduce your roll. Like you roll first and they're like, okay, I'll spend a heart to pull you back, to get you back from that perfect success, or to lift you up from the miss. So that's sort of a key clutch moment when the hearts that you've allowed other people to have of yours, which leaves you vulnerable, you know, can help you.
That's so fun. That was just like a personal delight question I wanted to ask, is because I'm just like, I love stuff like that. It's like when you can just be like, yeah, this is where you live up to the name of the game. Like this is where it happens.
I think mine in that is the other mechanic, the world scene, which I feel like has pulls of like that, those GM-less early versions of this game. Can you talk about what the world scene is and how people use it in the game?
After you make the world, like everybody builds a god, people take turns answering the questions and build the city, you build the other 3 world forces as appropriate, and you make your characters and their relationships with each other and what the different world forces have against them, and you're all ready to go with your game. But then first you play a world scene where it's an interlude, it's a brief scene where the players play members of one of the world forces. You pick which world force it is. Often it's the gods, but it could be any of the others, to sharpen and focus, okay, what are we going to be talking about first? What's the game really going to be about? Because a lot of stuff has been thrown out there in the building of the world and the characters and the relationships. You're like, okay, but what's our focus? And it's to answer a question. You figure out what question it is. The GM frames the scene and they decide when you've answered the question, but everything else is up to the players to play out in the voices of one of these world forces. And then after that, the GM can be like, okay, sweet, great, thank you, I got it. It works really well. Like I was afraid it would dull the drama, you know, because you're playing both sides kind of, but you're not really. You're just playing this side for a little bit. I really got it from the unseen that's in the between.
I was just going to say this reminds me of the unseen. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And also through the void, doesn't unseen, but it was the between that really, you know, started it. So Jason Cordova, great designer. So it's like that because the adventurers are not in it at all, but it's going to have consequences for them.
I imagine the benefit of this scene, the benefit of this scene is so multifaceted because A, it allows the players to have like more of their fingers in the world, which every time a game is able to do that explicitly, the players just get more invested because like, I helped build that. Now I care if someone knocks it over.
And it makes the GM look really good when they integrate the player's ideas.
And it, not only that, it's like, hey, I'm the GM and I'm saying, hey, what scene do you want to do for the world scene? We've got like 10 factions. And they say, ooh, we want to go to this faction. Well, now I know what my players care about. They, of the 10 factions, they wanted this faction. It's just a great way to, I feel like we're finding more and more games that are doing this that have a cycle of play, not only for the players, but also for the GM to just kind of give that extra little bit of assistance of like, hey, I as a GM have been doing this for a little while where maybe the world has gotten a little too sprawling. How do I check in with my players? And making that a mechanic is always helpful. It's just, again, that single thing that you can lean on in the game that takes the burden off of the GM's shoulders and puts it into the players or spreads it out throughout everyone. I just really like it.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Is it also, I want to say, a scene that you do between adventures, you know, so you are coming back to that. It could be different workforce each time, but yeah, exactly. Cause it's that check-in, just like you say. I also tried to make safety mechanics, mechanical too, like where you get XP for moving something around on the pallet grid. Pallet grid is from Seven Part Pack by Jay Dragon. So thank you for saying that, because I really like it when these things that improve the play are become relevant enough that you remember to do them.
Yeah. One of the kind of last things I want to talk about on Defy the Gods is that I got to hold the book at Gamma this past year, get to like see it. Ooh, look at it. It's very special edition. Oh yeah, show us the special edition. Oh,
God, I did not get enough of these printed, which is a good problem to have.
Ooh, holy shit.
Oh wait, wow.
This is art by Talia Schellen, gold foil.
Okay, yeah, no,
oh,
you
my
cooked
God,
with that
Chris.
One.
Yeah.
That is stunning.
Sometimes special editions underwhelm or just kind of whelm. That is an extremely good special edition cover. I'm looking at my shelf. That might be my favorite special edition cover I've ever seen.
Thank you so much. Tali Schellen in France did all the art for the the character, the playbooks, and she did that art and some other art in the game. She's just amazing. This is awesome. Also, I want to say Jacqueline.
Oh yeah,
yes.
Florencio in Brazil.
Core also looks great.
But I'm really psyched for the. Yeah, I'm. She knocked
out of the park. An amazing use of gold foil. Like I love foil. I'm a sucker for like gold foil and silver foil special editions. But I don't know, that such an illustrative foil use is really beautiful. I actually
and
am
apologies
like,
to the folks who are on audio only.
Yeah. Apologies to the folks on audio only. Honestly, if you're
Google
gonna go
it.
Check out our new Talk of the Table video release on YouTube, you should go just watch this little clip where Chris holds up that, because that is fucking gorgeous, and then go buy it.
There was such a question moment of like, can the printer wrap the gold foil around the board? Can the gold foil go to the bleed? Unfortunately, they did a great job with that. But like, that's one of those things I never would have thought of before actually doing shit like this.
And to pull it back, I feel like these are things that probably like the Horizons Fellowship helps out with, like of like, how do I negotiate with manufacturers and talk through and explain these things I want?
Yeah, yeah, 100%. Such a great resource. Like the Horizons Fellowship has like publisher panels you know, you sign up as a publisher or a retailer, and then there's panels for things publishers should know about by people who've been in the business for a while, and things retailers should know about. And that's really cool, because it's stuff like this. Yeah. What do you ask a printer? What do you ask a manufacturer?
I don't know.
Are those special editions for sale?
They sure are. Yeah.
Okay, hell yeah. Sorry, because I'm actually just like, that's like a selfish question and a listener question, because I'm like, holy shit, that's beautiful.
I'll have them at Origins, which I think happening immediately after this is released. I'd really love to see you guys there, if at all possible.
We'll stop by.
And then Plus One EXP will have them in their storefront, and I will have them in my storefront. And they'll be in distribution, so they should be available at your friendly local game store.
Hell yeah. Sick. Well, before we get you out of here, Chris, let's transition over to the other game we wanted to talk about today. We got so delighted in Defy the Gods, we've been focused up, but Raccoon Sky Pirates was kind of where your career started. Am I correct in saying?
100%.
2021. Yeah. What did Raccoon Sky Pirates in 2021 look like?
Oh my God. It was, it was this mailer box with like a zine in it. And, it started out, I was just going to do a zine, you know? Then I was like, I want to add a deck of cards and a 12-sided die, the loneliest die. Then it became a mailer box. Like, so, black and white, luscious black and white. And it was, it was a zine. It had some loose leaf sheets also, but it was all 8.5 by 11 folded. So it could, you know, fit in something like this. I did not work out shipping for a box in the Kickstarter, but never mind. That's a different conversation. And anyway, it was $25, great beer and pretzels game. And kind of at $25 with a deck and better cards, it was kind of an easy sell. And that was my entree. It was for Zine Quest, you know, like I was just going to make a zine. And that really was so much fun and really got me past like the doubt of, can I even make a game, you know? And I was really gratified by all the people who had fun with it. So now I'm making a bigger version.
I just got to shout out, because I had forgotten that this game came in a mailer box, just because I've seen the artwork, you know, everywhere. It's just kind of one of those like ubiquitous games for me. And I'd forgotten it comes in a mailer box. And Elliot reminded me when we were prepping for this, that is such a fucking good, like, indie scrappy way to make a box,
right?
It's so good.
Like, I'm shipping individual orders just with a mailing label on the back, and yeah.
And what this is like such a small little thing, but I think it's so good because like all of a sudden this product that is just a zine now has this like this box to it. It feels more like a premium product, and just slapping a label on the back of it feels proper for a game called Raccoon Sky Pirates. Like, it feels in world.
Yeah, scrappy, just like it could be janky, you know? Janky was a word I didn't even know I needed for this game until Avery Alder said it in a blurb. And like, yeah, it's janky. It's just this black and white thing. It looks almost like it was Xeroxed, you know? Yeah. The new one, so then like the challenge of the new one, right, is how to preserve that vibe and still have a bigger, all components in the box, higher price point kind of thing. And and what I went with was like trying to make it as many of the components as possible look like they're stolen from other games.
Mm.
Hell yeah, that's great.
Like,
yeah.
You've got a frame board that's like a Monopoly-esque board with all cut, middle cut out, and you put Catan tiles down in it to navigate across the neighborhood. Like shit like that. Like random mismatched tiles that you use to set your options on your character sheet or your playboard. So yeah, tried to like, oh, and like the box itself looks like a, you know, some weird board game that just got white out put all over the outside. So trying to keep that vibe but still make it like you feel more premium. Yeah,
I think it's great to have that like that preview version early on of like, I know what I want the premium version to look like in my head, but it's my first game, I don't quite know all the stuff yet. But let me get as close as I can. And I think so few people make that big leap because it is a tougher thing to do.
That's such good advice. And I wasn't even thinking of it that way at the time because I was just in a manic haze and I was just making whatever. Like,
I get that.
But like, I think that's a really good idea, right? Is have a lofty vision and then scale it back and make it humble and just make what you can do without breaking your back or your bank account, you know, and get it out there. I mean, it's I guess it's like the physical version of the itch.io PDF that you maybe put out there for free with no graphics or very few, you know, self-made graphics. And you're just like, yeah, scrappy, get a sense of what people like of the mechanics. It almost becomes like a public playtest, a public beta, and just see, God, I should have done that with more things. Yeah.
It reminds me of my own game Project Echo. I wanted to bundle a planner and a book. And so I tied them together with red string, and I have done that for 3 years since it came out, tying together like bundles with red string. And now I'm starting to, in the early days of thinking about a second edition, I'm like, no string. We're not doing the, well, that was, no, it, string you. Was the scrappy figure out how to bundle two games without like getting a shrink wrapper and like all this kind of stuff. It's like, no, it's like, we're not doing that again.
Cause like, yeah, I feel that. Because I assembled all these Red King Sky Pirates in my living room, you know? I got a postage scale, all this shit. You know, like, you know, getting all these components from different places and I'm folding up all the boxes and putting it in. And now I'm like, I'm not folding any more boxes.
We've moved past the folding boxes stage.
I love that you really reflexively went back to your neck. Because I imagine that is one of those things where it's just like you're hunched over and all of a sudden you get up and you're like, oh, God.
So the Total Chaos Edition, what is new? You mentioned some of the components. Is anything mechanically changing? What's the full upgrade look like?
Yeah, I streamlined the mechanics. Like in the original, you're playing cards that are complications cards that you can play to kind of fix what would be ratcheting up the disaster track. And this time the cards are the disaster track. Like there's still only a certain number you can play, but what you're playing is how things have gone horribly wrong. And so that streamlines things a bit because some of the mechanics around those original cards are a little funky, a little weird. Like there's a weird push your luck kind of thing going on with those. And so in this one, you pull back from disaster by sacrificing a piece of trash. Every piece of trash is a poker chip that you're writing on with dry erase marker or a little drawing to say what it is. So you start out with a couple so that you can give those up and they go out of the game forever in order to fix a disaster card. And then you get to say what that actually looks like, you know, in the game. But it means that how much loot you have at the end is going to be less. So that's the biggest mechanical change. You're still rolling to see what you do. Every raccoon has a different list of things they might do. And you still have approaches and, you know, based on your choices, what you do is helpful or not, but it's still random what you do. And you do, instead of having a pre-made neighborhoods map, you are laying down these hex tiles. So you don't really know what you're going to encounter. You're always going to the same location, but that location might end up being one of three different houses. Oh my God. And you guys, I'm also getting the house maps drawn by professional architects.
That's great. Yeah.
Fun. In the first one, I just stole some from real estate sites on the web. and in this one, I tried to credit them. I credited them, I think. But like in this one, it's a whole new bespoke maps and those architects going crazy, just going ham. Like, okay, what's the most egregious over-the-top ranch house? What's a way too Victorian house, things like that.
I gotta think architects don't get to have that kind of fun that often.
Right?
Yeah.
They get to have fun, but not like make an obscene house.
Right. And this was part of what was really great about putting out the lo-fi version of Raccoon Sky Pirates is that they reached out to me. They were like, hey, we played this game, really? We love it. We want to make some maps. I mean, I'm paying them, but you know, like
sure, yeah. But that's awesome.
They volunteered to the job. Yeah. Yeah, it's really great.
This is just another reminder that the TTRPG community is very, very kind and very, very nice. And like everyone kind of wants to help out as best they can. There's not a lot of money to go around. So we all know that it's like, hey, we got to have fun doing it. Otherwise, why are we doing it?
Yeah, that's the bright side. The dark side is sometimes people don't really feel a need to act very professionally or like when shit hits a fan, they kind of go to pieces because we're not professionals. We're just all fans. We're just doing this because we love it. But then the upside, the you know, the bright side is that, yeah, we just all want to see some good games and we love this stuff and we mostly know each other. You know?
Right. It's small. It's small. Yeah, that feels like another, I think, benefit of programs like Horizons is giving you that sense of like, yeah, this is a profession as well. You know what I mean? Like, this is like how you build a career. It's like, yeah, it's all fun and we love games, but like, here are the business realities you also have to consider.
It's both, you know, it gets you much better acquainted with those business realities, maybe despite yourself. And it introduces you to more of that community and helps you know more people. Because it is small, but it can sometimes feel daunting all the same. Maybe because everyone else knows each other already and you're like, hi, can I sit at your lunch table?
Chris, our final question that we like to ask everyone who comes on Talk of the Table is, what are you bringing to the table? And this is just our cute way of asking you for a recommendation for our audience of anything. It doesn't have to be in games, but it can be. It could be a game, a resource, a book, a show. It could be to go outside and sniff a flower today. Chris Sellers, what would you like to bring to the table today?
I recently got Xenia's Wonder Tales, and we played it, and it is so lovely, so folktale, while still feeling like something that you are deciding in real time with real stakes. A lovely alternative to For the Queen in terms of building characters in a story progressively and with no prep, while still keeping you on track and keeping you geared towards drama. I love it. It's so good. I also recently haven't played yet, Last Train to Bremen, which is so good.
It's good. Yeah.
It's one of my favorite games. Yeah.
Oh, it's the total package, you know, that the drawings with that kind of 19th century woodcut style and the town musicians of Bremen call out and the liar's dice and the deal with the devil. And it's so good. So looking forward to bringing that to my table soon. And I hope everyone else can bring it to theirs.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for coming to the table. Do you want to let people know where they can find you online if they're looking for you?
Yeah, I'm at Hectic Electron on Instagram and Tumblr and Blue Sky. Not Hectic Electric, just Hectic Electron. And I've got a newsletter that you can find on my website called The Everlasting Neverending Game Night, which is just trying to be good vibes and game talk. And my games are being sold at +1 EXP. And I think that's it.
Love it. Put all those links in the show notes below as well. And if you want more gaming content from us here at Talk of the Table, you can become a member of the Many Sided Media Patreon. Just a couple bucks a month, you can get bonus roundtables from Talk of the Table. You can get bonus chats from just me and Elliot, where we go deep into detail, like very explicit numbers and behind the scenes stuff of like how Elliot's game design business is doing, how Many Sided Media is doing. So you can get like a real true glimpse behind the scene of like, hey, this is exactly how much money we're not making. But also we've got a bunch of extra bonus actual plays from My First Dungeon, including a bunch of actual plays run by the game designers themselves, so definitely go check those out. Rate, review, and follow Talk of the Table wherever you get your podcasts, and that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.